On episode 196 of the Tennis Files podcast, you'll learn 4 pro-level strategies to win more matches at the club level using data from over 1 million points with special guest Fabrice Sparrow.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
Welcome to the Tennis Files Podcast, bringing you advice from the top minds in tennis to help you improve your game. And now, here's your host, Mehrban Iranshad.
Hey everyone, this is Mehrban Iranshad. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. It's been a long few weeks. I am just about wrapping up the Tennis Summit 2021. It was amazing, and we got well over 11,000 people to attend and over 45 plus sessions, like I think 10 or 12 live streams. Pretty awesome. And I've still got a couple more to do, believe it or not. But yeah, we've got a great episode today to give you 4 pro level strategies to help you win more matches at the club level with Fabrice Sparrow. And I do have a forthcoming intro in the next clip, I guess I could say, but it's the full interview with Fabrice, about, you know, 50 minutes or so. And I really hope that you enjoy and become enlightened by the strategies that Fabrice will present to you in just a moment. So without further ado, here is my interview with Fabrice Sparrow.
Hey everybody, welcome to this very exciting conversation on the 4 pro-level strategies that you can use to win more matches at the club level. And I'm really excited to have Fabrice Sparrow on the, on this conversation. And Fabrice is just a fantastic mind, has a great story in terms of how he came to be from a coach to a, more specifically, a data analyst. And he's been helping some of the most amazing players on the planet, like Daniil Medvedev, who you've probably heard of, Nicolas Mahut, and many others. And so I wanted to talk to Fabrice today, because he has analyzed, I think, well over a million points at this point. And it's incredible. And, you know, it's really important. You know, I've had other people on interviews before talk about this, like Craig O'Shaughnessy. And it's an innovative way to be able to analyze what is really going on, have concrete data behind what your strategies and tactics are. So, Fabrice, I really appreciate you coming on to speak with me. And thanks so much.
Thank you. I mean, thank you for inviting me. So,
yeah, anytime, Fabrice. And so, I think it's really important to get to your story first off. I know that everybody is chomping at the bit to have the strategies revealed, but I think your story will highlight the importance of analyzing data. So if you could kind of just get into that for us, it would be really fascinating to hear about.
I mean, my story about the coach, like from the coach to the data analysis.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Perfect. So, I started coaching at the end at the age of 2021. It became my passion from the start, and very early, I had this dream of becoming a tour coach, and it was with my own players at that time. So I can say I started with a local project and we reached national level pretty soon with my first project with 2 brothers. And in 2007, I'm even sure, somebody introduced me to statistics. It was a French guy called Olivier Soulès, and he showed me how to chart a match. And I must say that from that moment, I totally fell in love with charting matches. And I first used it for me as a coach to become a better coach. Because, you know, there is something important to know is like when you were not a former professional tennis player yourself, it's very difficult to reach, to coach or to be on the tour with the best in the world. So I thought at that stage that I needed something extra, and stats, I liked stats already. And when he showed me how to chart a match, I totally fell in love with it. And I use it for my players. And I use it for many other things like studies and other things. I really love the whole package. And so I don't know if I, so from that moment was 2007, I started working with my own players with stats. And in 2014, I started working for small academies, at the national level. And I was doing like analysis of their players. So I started to do a bit more stats than before. And then I go briefly. And then in 2019, I had the chance to meet Daniil Medvedev's coach, Gilles Savara, in Montreal. And we had a trial of a match preparation with stats. And the coach really liked it. And from that moment, I've been working with the coach for 1.5 years. So in the introduction, you said that I was the statistician of Medvedev, but it's not the case. I just work for the coach. And after that, I started working with Nicolas Mahut. And now this year, I started with Félix Auger-Aliassime's team and Marie Bouskova. So this is briefly my story. I mean, of course, I forgot a couple of things, but this is briefly my story.
Yeah, thanks, Fabrice. I appreciate you diving into the story for us. And but you know, why is data analysis so important? Like, what is it about it? I mean, you've spoken about how, you know, your goal is to help athletes reach that extra 1% because that actually can make a huge impact. So can you talk about that 1% and why data analysis is so important to help players?
Okay. So first I need to say that during a lot of years, statistics, that nobody really cared about it. So, I mean, I've been doing statistics for 14 years, like 4 to 5 hours per day. And I have to say that during 12 years, nobody really cared about statistics. And now from 2020-21, people start to care more and more. So this is first of all to say that this is pretty new, that people are more interested in my work or in statistics in tennis in general. And second, the 1%, how I explain it is in his career, people like Nadal, Federer, Djokovic, they won 54% of the points. And a player who is ranked in the top 100, let's say 50 in the world, would win 50% of the points he played. So between a Federer, Djokovic, and Nadal, and a player ranked 50, 60, 70 in the world, there are only 4% of points difference. So when we are conscious that this is only 4% difference between the greatest and the rest of the top 100, then 1% is much more than what we think.
No, that is just amazing. You know, when doing some research on you and seeing how just like 1 or 2 percentage point between like Gasquet. Say example Gasquet, Gasquet, and then and the top, and that's a lot in terms of rankings and prize money and all that stuff.
So I made calculation about that, but I mean 1%, if you are top 10, 1% means maybe million of dollars. And if you are like 150, you can maybe break into the top 100 and you're going to earn, I don't know, maybe $200,000 more dollars. So 1% equals a lot of money. So if we see it this way, I mean, that's not the way I like to say it, but if we say it this way, 1% is a lot. It's more win, more money, maybe more sponsors. It's much more than what we think.
Yeah, for sure. And very similarly, I mean, for the club players out there, I mean, this can be the difference between putting you at the top of your level and, you know, at the middle or bottom. So Fabrice, yeah, with that, I want to launch into these pro level strategies that that our fellow amateur players can use at the at their level. So can you introduce us to the first one?
Oh, okay, so first of all, I need to say that I wrote a book about that, but it's in French. Sorry, I don't make this in French. And there are something like 51 strategies that can work from the pro players to the amateur level. So, and out of these 51, what I call optimizations, I will pick up four that I think are good examples. But these four are just four out of 50 that we know. So I start right now. The first one is the serve variation. So what I call at an amateur level, many times it happened that the player serve all the time the same spot and he doesn't vary well. He serve with the other spot. Like for instance, he serve the tee or the wide serve on his opponent's backhand and the pro, this is a strategy that they don't do anymore. If you want to know the last players doing this kind of strategy were the clay court players like Philippe Auvelandry or maybe other players, but now in the last 10 years, more or less, everybody's varying well the serve. But at an amateur level, still, I mean, I worked also with amateur, still their serve are stereotyped, which means they serve too many times the same spot. So my first pro level strategy would be you should serve as many wide serve as T serve. And if you have somebody to chart your match or if you have somebody who can take notes, the difference between the wide and the T serve should not exceed 10%. For instance, if you serve 45% wide and 55% T, this is a difference of 10%. So this is the first advice I can give you is vary your serve and not more than 10% difference between the wide and the tee. And another thing I can say about that is, we talk a lot about the body serve, but it turns out that the body serve is the worst service area to serve in single and at a pro level, but also at an amateur level. So me, I would recommend to serve as less as you can body serve and to get that strategy is to serve as many wide than T serve. And to do so, I use with some juniors what I call a serve plan, which means that on the first four serves, you have to serve the four areas. So for instance, wide, T, T. And that's your four first serves of each game. Sorry. And then from the fifth point, you can do it again. Or if you feel like you can serve your best service areas. So this is more or less my first tip out of the four I'm going to give it today.
That's very fascinating, Fabrice, and of course, appreciate that. And that is very interesting. So, I mean, basically, when you looked at the data, the body serve, like, did that just ended up losing the most points out of all the other types of serves?
Yes. Yes. Of AC service winner. I mean, a body serve can bother you. But a T serve or a wide serve can just not bother you, but kill you. And this is the main difference between the body and the other serve. Is the body serve is you get less aces service winner on the pro tour. And we have the same tendency at an amateur level. That's why, sorry for that. But that's why and also at an amateur level, you know, sometimes they're not accurate enough. So they will serve body serve in any case. So it's better to avoid them because in any case, sometimes it's going to come. So it I prefer to say never serve the body, because it's going to come naturally from time to time when you miss one area, and focus on the wide and the T serve.
Thanks, Fabrice. Yeah, I mean, that's definitely true. You know, I've made the mistake myself, and also have experienced the fortunate aspect of, you know, the body serve. Sometimes it's a little bit off, and then they position a little bit and hit a big forehand, and, like, you know, they're more comfortable rather than moving them around the box.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I guess... Is there a preference toward, like, is it better to serve a little bit more wide than T, or does it not really matter and you just split it for the most part?
I mean, the pro, they have a tendency to serve a bit more the T on deuce court and the wide on at court. But then some other pro, maybe I think like Djokovic, serve a bit more the slice, but most of the pro, they serve a bit more the T and the wide. Which means for a right-handed, so the flat serve, and all the lefty, they have a tendency to serve also with the slice serve, the T and the wide serve. So I cannot say that. I mean, I feel like that every player has to know which serve area he's good at and which serve area he's not good at. So that's why in the serve plan we use the first four serve at the beginning, and then from the fifth serve, you can go to your strength. And I don't think that they are. I mean, some players can be better with slice, other one with flat or kick. So I think it doesn't really matter.
Thanks, Fabrice. So, okay, great. So I guess an easy plan, like you said, the service plan is just, you know, for the first 4 points, you just pick each side, you know, T wide, in any pattern that you want. And then from there, go for your strength, but then still probably want to vary it up. Is that kind of the summation of it?
Exactly. Yeah. First variation. Second, go to your strength.
Got it.
That's really good. And also, I mean, it's important as an amateur that you know yourself. Where are my strengths when I serve? Where are my weaknesses when I serve? This is also something that they have to know.
Yeah, for sure. And in any, like, just overall in your game, you need to know that so you can apply the strengths as much as you can. So amazing. Any other last thoughts on this one, Fabrice, before we go to the second strategy?
No. I think I said everything I had to say about this first variation. Yes. Maybe one last thing. We are talking about the first serve. On the second serve at an amateur level, put it in. That's the most important thing. Put your second serve in. And if you feel better in this specific area, like the T, then wide, do it. Because, you know, the ratio of double faults is one of the, is even the main key explaining a low second serve 1 point. So at an amateur level, I think it's the point number one explaining a low second serve 1 point. So this is for first serve, the variation. On second serve, do what you can.
Got it. Yes. Thanks so much for covering that second serve. I'm glad you brought that up. Just curious, one last follow-up with that. I know, as you said, the priority is to get it in, maybe figure out what is your best second serve here and then go with that. But is there any, like, say if somebody is a really good second server, you know, then is there any, like, particular side that is most advantageous, or is it the same principles?
I mean, most of the second serve, we play with a kick or whatever on the rival's back end. But it turned out that somebody like Djokovic, again, he very well went body or T. So there are no, especially a rule. Everything can work as long as this is your strength. So, I mean, the tendency is to go kick to the back end. This is the tendency. But then if you can do other things, do it. And also some people, they got scared if they don't have a good second serve because they go only the slice. I'm talking about right-handed. They go slice to the forehand of the opponent. And, you know, it could also be a good option to go to the forehand. I mean, then it depends. If your serve is too weak, maybe no. But a good slice, if you don't have a good kick on second serve, but only a good slice, go to the forehand. No problem for me.
Brilliant, brilliant. Thanks again, Fabrice. So that's a great one. I hope everybody here is taking notes on this. And I mean, I'm personally excited to think about my serve like this and vary it up and keep the opponents guessing. So Fabrice, how about we go to the second pro level strategy that club level players can use?
Exactly. So the second strategy is to build your point cross. I mean, this is a basic, very basic strategy, but we still have to know that when we play cross, the net is lower and you have more distance. So I start with an easy thing, and I'm going to pick up an interesting example of a pro player. And let's do it this way. So the example I want to take for the playing cross, building cross, is Juan Martin Del Potro. So Juan Martin Del Potro, everybody think, and I'm sure that everybody who's listening to us right now think that Del Potro is better than his opponent. Well, he's not playing anymore right now, but was better than his opponent because he was making more winners, or what I call provoked points, than them. But stats revealed that the biggest advantage that Del Potro took against his opponent, it was because he was doing 30% fewer unforced errors than them. So this is already a first thing about Del Potro, which is interesting. So he make on average the same ratio of winners provoked point, but 30% fewer unforced errors with the forehand and the backhand than his opponent. And he's the best example about the building cross. 2/3 of Del Potro's shots are playing cross. So forehand cross, forehand inside out, and backhand cross. So two times out of three, on average, he played cross. So this cross allowed him to put pressure to his opponent and to play a safe target. And this safe target plus pace that he could put justified in a way that he was doing 30% fewer unforced errors than his opponent. So, and then when he has the right ball, Del Potro used to go down the line with the same pace. So this is exactly the example the good strategical example I want to tell you. So you build cross, the net is lower, the distance is bigger, you can generate pace cross with safety. And when you have the right ball, you can keep the same pace, but play down the line. And this is one of the things Del Potro was doing perfectly.
That's fantastic, Fabrice. Thanks for that. So I guess the message here is to really go cross court until you get a ball that is comfortable for you to go down the line. Is that correct? Are there any variations to that?
There could be many variations because, I mean, this strategy, I cannot say that this strategy can work for everybody. Let's say that one of the player listening to us has a very, very good forehand. And maybe for him, it's good to go more with the forehand down the line, you know, or the inside in. But this is the cross strategies is something used a lot with the backhand actually on the tour. But I like the example of Del Potro just to explain how he was winning his match, statistics with stats. But I'm not sure that this strategy can apply to anybody. I'm not sure.
Yeah, but I think this is a extremely valid one. Obviously, I mean, you have data behind it, and also, it's very common in even the pro level too, of course, right? But as you just mentioned, but club level especially, that it's really the game of errors. And so if you're hitting to a place where the net is lower and you have a more of a distance, so for you to hit the ball cross court, then naturally you're going to make less errors. And so it's just going to, you know, encourage winning.
Yeah, but I would say that the cross things is really useful for the backhand. We have to know that on the ATP tour and even at an amateur level, when you play a backhand down the line, your chances to win the rally directly or after a couple of shots after the backhand down the line is 46%. So 46% is 4% less than 50. No, the 50% bar is the I win as many points as I lose. This is 50%. So when you play a backhand down the line, you have to know that your chances, or the general chances, are 46. So the playing cross thing with the backhand is useful. With the forehand, as I said previously, it's very effective to go down the line also, with 54% of the points won on average.
Thanks, Fabrice. Very fascinating statistics there. Just curious, like when you're counting all the points and the percentages and whatnot, when players go backhand down the line, like it's all sorts of shots, right? It's like if they're being rushed and they're going for it, and also if they're comfortable, like all of those, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's all the shots. Yeah. I mean, this is the global average. Of course, when this shot is played exactly at the right timing and at the right moment, like maybe Del Potro was doing it perfectly, or Andre Agassi was a huge example of almost the same strategy as Juan Martín Del Potro. Cross, cross, cross the right ball, I go down the line. So if you really master this change between the cross and the down the line at the right moment, it can be very effective, the down the line, also with the backhand.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at newbalance.com.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Thanks, Fabrice. Appreciate that. Are there any other closing thoughts on this strategy before we forge ahead with the third one?
No, I think we went through. I think it's okay.
Perfect, perfect. Well, thanks for that. Another great one. So I guess we can go to the next one.
Yeah. So the next one is not a strategy, but it's something that you players have to be very careful with. This is the backhand slice. So just, you know, we're talking a lot about variation. And, you know, every time you hear the commentator on TV, they say, oh, that's a good variation, blah, blah, blah. So all the time, variation has a positive impact. That's what they say. But the numbers, they say more or less the opposite about some of the variation. And the slice variation, the backhand slice variation, is tricky one. So when a pro player, WTA or ATP, play a backhand slice, the probability to win the rally is 44%. So this is something that we have to know. Like, and to give you another example, if you win 44% of the points in a match, you're going to lose 6-2, 6-3, I think, something like that. So the variation with the backhand slice is a tricky one, and not a lot of players win more than 50% after playing a backhand slice. So I wanted to take this strategy because actually it's a strategy maybe not to do, or to be very careful with the backhand slice. So I'm going to take, there is one example I give about this one that maybe some people's going to hate me about it, but all the time I use this one.
Not me.
Roger Federer. Sorry.
Go ahead.
So
sorry.
Roger Federer, after playing a backhand slice, win only 48% of the points on my study. So all the numbers I give you are part of my own database and my own studies I made on these players. And for instance, Federer, I have 500 backhand slice played. And on these 500 backhand slice played, they are not defensive. This is very important. It's not like he couldn't reach the ball and he played a slice on the side. This is not counted. It's every time I count a backhand slice, I counted that he could have played with topspin and he chose a slice. And out of that, he won 48% of his points. So the below, again, the 50% bar.
Very interesting, Fabrice. I can see that. I mean, especially at the amateur level, or the slices aren't always the most effective. Sometimes they float, and that's interesting. Why do you think it is that that the backhand slice isn't as successful?
I think on the tour, one of the reasons is like now the forehand topspin are improved a lot. Let's say that because they improved, they can easily generate pace on a slower ball like the slice. So this is one of the reasons on the tour, because on the tour, they executed well the slice. I mean, when you look at Roger Federer's slice, the shot is perfect. It's almost perfect, technically perfect. You cannot say that it's because of the shot or because he missed it. It's the consequence of that shot at the pro level that they can generate pace on a slice ball. So this is one of the reasons. At an amateur level, as you mentioned it, they make more errors with backhand slice. So it's not so easy. The ball can float or float out. So and still, you don't generate a lot of pace with a backhand slice. So, I mean, my advice would be that if you have the two shots, the top spin and the backhand slice, be very careful when you use the backhand slice. And there are two situations where the backhand slice could be useful, effective, is the backhand slice approach. She got more than 50% of the points won. And if you can master it, the backhand slice, the short one. Then, if you don't have these two options, you can only do backhand slice, because there are many amateur level, they can only slice on the backhand. And on the tour, there are two players that all the time slice with the backhand. It's Feliciano Lopez and Steve Johnson. And I just want to give you the numbers when they do a backhand slice. So Lopez win 44% of the point after a backhand slice, and Steve Johnson 42 in my research. So I think I cover more or less everything I had to say about this backhand slice.
Yeah, that is wonderful. And that's great that you touched upon those players, because I was thinking specifically of Stevie Johnson. I was going to ask you, you know, how about his rate? But it seems that he, you know, fortunately, that's pretty low. You wouldn't think that, but at least he's got, a good serve and forehand.
Exactly.
It's very interesting. Just curious, do you have any data on, you mentioned that the slice approach is more successful over 50%. Is there like a particular location or anything like that that makes it successful?
I think, the backhand slice approach on the opponent's backhand is the best. You know, we made a huge study on Stefan Edberg, and it turned out that the only slice approach, the only backhand he got more than 55% of the points won, or even 50, was the backhand slice cross approach. All the rest, he got below the 50%. So I would say I would recommend definitely the backhand slice approach to the backhand, not the forehand. Because as I said before, now we have many, many players mastering the topspin forehand, and it's not so complicated to play forehand passing.
Got it, Fabrice. Awesome. And one last one, which I'm just going to throw out an assumption, is that it would probably be higher percentage based on what you said to slice to the backhand rather than to the forehand then, right?
Yeah, exactly. To slice to the backhand. And I just want to add another thing about the slice, because there is one situation where the slice is very effective, is on the first serve return. You know, on the first serve return, returning with slice is very important, because you can put back in play many balls. So this is the only situation where the slice is effective on the first serve return, especially if you play against big servers. This is where the guys, they get good stats with the backhand slice.
Got it. Thanks, Fabrice. So first serve slice is good, but second serve, you probably want to hit that topspin backhand instead of the slice.
The second serve return is better to play spin and to put pressure. Then the position is, we thought that a close position to the baseline was very very important before. And now the latest studies I made is like a further back position, even on second serve return, even is more effective. So the slice, the backend slice return only on first serve. I mean, then if you don't have any other option, you have to do it on second serve. But you have to know this is not an effective shot.
Wow. Wow. Very cool. Very cool. Fabrizio, I think you need to translate that book to English at some point. I don't know what your plans are, but that would be pretty cool for us.
I need to find someone to, you know, in France, we're making podcasts about the book in French. And I need someone to do that with me for the English speaker, and I would be glad to do it because they have 50, no, not 50. We made something like 30 to 35 keys for amateur level from the pro, like 30 pro strategies that you can use at an amateur level. And we did that with a French podcast, Tennis Legend. And if somebody is interested in the States, we can do it this way. Yep.
Very cool. Very cool. Really enjoying this, Fabrice. Appreciate it. So, let's leap into pro strategy number four.
Yeah. So the last pro strategy is the forehand and the backhand approach. So when a shot is followed to the net, it becomes more effective. To give you a simple example, the winner unforced errors ratio with the forehand on the Pro Tour is 1-1. On average, they make one winner or what I call the provoked point. Provoked point is like you hit a good forehand, the other one touch it, but you win the point. So this is 1-1. They make on average 1 point with the forehand for one error. But when you use the approach, this ratio turns to 4 points for one error. So the ratio winners and force is multiplied by 4 if you follow your forehand to the net. And the backhand is multiplied by 3.5 in my research. So just to say that if you have a chance, if you have an opportunity, follow your forehand and your backhand more often to the net because it will optimize your performances. So, and we have to say two things. First, when you follow a shot to the net, it increases the pressure you put on your rival and he can just miss the passing. And second, technically, when you follow a shot to the net, the whole body goes through the ball. So this is more or less the two things that explain why a forehand or a backhand approach is more effective.
Wow, that's great. Makes a lot of sense there, putting that pressure in addition to the shot and having that forward momentum, like you mentioned. Is there I guess location wise, are we trying to hit to the back end all the time, or how about that aspect of it?
Yeah, I mean the pro player, they can hit everywhere. I mean backhand cross, down the line, forehand inside out, inside. But I would say that the most effective approach is definitely the forehand down the line. This is the number one. Then still a forehand approach is more effective than the backhand approach usually. But if you have a better backhand than forehand, so in your case it would be maybe the backhand approach more effective. But let's say the down the line are good way to approach. And if we go back to the Del Potro strategy, you build your point cross, injecting pace cross. And when you have the right ball, you play down the line with a forehand or a backhand approach. And this is a strategy, a pro strategy that can be very, very useful at an amateur level.
Fantastic, Fabrice. That's really great. Are there any other thoughts on that in terms of, I guess, the optimal approach? Well, okay, so let's go with this. Are there any, like, instances that you found where the approach was less successful? Like, I don't know, maybe depending on the location of where they were when they approached?
Okay. No, there's nothing. No, there is nothing below the 50% bar when you approach, on average. Nothing. Every direction will give you minimum of 60%. I mean, this is an average. Minimum 65% of the points on average. 60 to 65. You know, it's not like a backhand slice that the average is 44%. An approach is all the time over 60% of the points won. Of course, it can happen in a match that you win less than 60 or 50% of the points, but it doesn't happen that much. And I also want to say a thing that When you follow your shot to the net, even for a player that doesn't like to volley or doesn't have any confidence in his volley, you know that I calculate that 65% of the time, you won't have a volley to play. Or you'll finish the point in a good or in a bad way, or you will be passed, or you will have a volley to play. And the volley to play at the pro tour, pro level is 35% of the time you will have to play a volley. So this, for me, I use this argument for the players who have a good forehand, for instance, or good backhand, but they don't want to go to the net. And I just tell them, your forehand is good enough that you won't have that many volley to play. So don't be so scared of the volley. But of course, if you have a better volley, that would help. And with a better volley, it will give you also the confidence to come to the net more often.
That's amazing, Fabrice. Yeah, so that's really great because we do have a lot of players who aren't as confident in their net play, but just the mere act of approaching, it seems like, you know, two out of the three times you won't even need to hit a volley. So yeah, but even more at amateur level.
Yeah, but still it depends on your approach. I mean, at an amateur level, if you do an approach like this, very, very slow, you will have more than 35% of volley. I mean, we're talking about a good approach. Like you had the time, you settled down and you hit a forehand on the backhand. A good one. We're not talking about, oh, I approach because Fabrice tell me to approach and I play a very soft ball. No, we're talking about a good approach also.
Thanks, Fabrice. So I guess if we were thinking about maybe like a 3-0, 3-5, they don't have as much on their approach and they're going to get volleys more often, then should we change the strategy? I mean, how would you change the strategy in that case then?
You mean if you don't come to the net enough?
Oh, no, sorry. So like basically if you are not capable yet of hitting like a pretty solid approach. Because sometimes if you watch like 3-0 or 3-5 players, you know, they might just hit the soft approaches like you mentioned. So how should they adjust then? Should they maybe not come to net as much then?
If they are very confident with their volley, it's okay because they're going to counterbalance the bad approach with a good volley. So that could be one of the solutions. But still, all the time when I talk about strategy, we reach a point that if you don't have the weapon, I mean, if you don't have the serve, the forehand, the backhand, you need the technique. I mean, you need a minimum of technique. And strategy is good when you have the weapon or when you in order to know how to use your weapon or your not weapon. But for the approach of the volley, it's good to take private lesson with a professional teaching you how to do it also. It's very important because if you don't have the approach and you don't have the volley, I'm not sure that this strategy is the best for you.
Awesome. Thanks, Fabrice. These were amazing strategies. And, you know, I'll just try to outline them real quick here again. So the first one is serve variation, you know, serving to both wide and to the tee with maybe a 10% plus minus on that. And then the second one is to build the point primarily with your cross court shots. The third one is just to be cognizant that the backhand slice has lower than a 50% success rate. So try to hit topspin as much as you can. And then the last one is that approaching your forehands and backhands to the net will give you a significantly more, a higher success rate and you might not even need to hit a volley. So are those correct? I just want to make sure I didn't bungle those.
That's perfect. That's perfect. You got it, Melbourne. You got it perfectly. That's it.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're gonna play better tennis now.
I will for sure. I know I will. These are awesome strategies, and I love them, and I appreciate you letting us know about them. I know, Fabrice, that you also wanted to chat a little bit about just how statistics reports can really be used at any level to improve any player.
Yeah, exactly. So right now, the statistic report is more and more common on the tour. But I've been working with any kind of level. And, you know, sometimes people told me that, oh, but at an amateur or intermediate level, you know, a stats report is not useful because they don't have enough shots. They miss so many things. But But I have to say no, that a stats report can be useful at every level, because you will become conscious of your strengths and weaknesses with number. You know, the good thing about number is numbers are stronger than belief in a way. You know, because they will tell you for real, I mean, more or less for real, that this works for me and this doesn't work for me. And you can really build your confidence with statistics and with a statistics report at any level. You can, as I said, you can know your game style a bit better. You can know your strengths, weaknesses, how you win the point, how you lose the point, what works for you and what doesn't work for you. So something I want to talk about, that at any level, the stats report are useful, not only at the pro level.
Gotcha, Fabrice, for sure. And I want to educate the audience on, you know, what you're doing right now. If there are any particular services or any content that you have that they can check out, because I mean, this is, as we've spoken about, game changing stuff. So, just talk a bit about what you're up to and how they can maybe connect.
So yes, right now we've been talking with data science, with one of the data scientists I work with, to create a cheaper product that the amateur can afford easily. And maybe in this report, they won't have all the stats from the pro, because maybe they don't need all the specific, but really I saw the product we made with this data scientist, and it's very an outstanding product. It's a report of more or less 10 to 15 pages, and very affordable. So, and it's brand new. We just finished it 2 weeks ago, not 1 week ago. And one of our goals now is to promote it a bit more. I mean, my passion is the top 100, the pro level. But if I can help with these strategies to a lower level, I also want to do it, because this is part of our job to help at any level, I think.
Awesome. Love it, Fabrice. And so where can we, and sorry if you mentioned this, but what website or where can we go to stay updated and to check that out?
I still need to create the thing on my internet site, so tennisprofiler.com, but it will come soon. And I think from my site, you can easily check what the product is, and maybe I will send you a sample or to explain more in depth how it works. So I told you it's brand new. And I need to adjust my internet site, how to do it. Or maybe we're going to have people like, providers promoting it for us. It's totally new. So I'm happy to talk about this product with you, because the first time I talk about it in public, I would say. But there will be ways, like on my site and on other providers for sure, and soon.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. Well, everybody should definitely 100% check out tennisprofiler.com to see what Fabrice is up to and to check that out, which is going to be exciting. So definitely keep updated by checking out the website. Fabrice, is there any other places that we can go to follow you, such as your social profiles or anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, it's always under my name. So Fabrice Sbarro, S-B-A-R-R-O, Fabrice. So, I mean, it's easy to connect with me. And I answer to all the message I got when I receive some. So it's easy to get in touch with me.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Fabrice. I really appreciate it. I guess before we go, any last words on, any tips on data analysis or anything you want to give as a like a parting piece of advice to the audience?
I feel like that more or less we covered enough for the 30-40 minutes we had. There are still many topics in stats. It's just like limitless in a way. But I think we covered more or less. More tips will be if one day I make that podcast in English, I will have the 30-35 tips. And more tips will be given with the stats report. But right now, I think we we covered already four, which I think is good. It's a good to that people realize that how stats can be important and improve their game.
For sure. Well, Fabrice, I really want to thank you so much for your time. I mean, you're working for teams for the top players in the game today and really making a huge difference. And I can't thank you enough for these great strategies that if the audience implements them, maybe just choose one or two and try them and see how exactly well it works already. For you. Yeah. That's usually how to do it. Then we'll, I'm sure we'll see a great difference in your game. So thank you so much. Hopefully. And looking forward to chatting with you again soon.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
All right. I really hope you enjoyed my interview with tennis strategist Fabrice Sparrow, and definitely check out his work at tennisprofiler.com if you're interested in learning more about what he does and getting more strategic information for how to improve your game. And I really would also appreciate it if you would subscribe to the Tennis Files podcast. I think it would benefit you, you know, a good deal by getting all the episodes downloaded automatically as soon as I push them out. And it would also help the show a lot in terms of visibility and higher rankings and such. So that would be appreciated. I also would like to leave you with a quote, as I often do at the end of the podcast. And this one is by Albert Einstein. And Albert said, "The important thing is not to stop questioning. Curiosity has its own reason for existence." Really love this one because you'll obviously stagnate if you do not constantly question what you're doing on the court and how you can improve, which is how a lot of people get stuck at a certain level. So if you have curiosity and also passion and you're willing to work hard, then that's when all the magic will happen eventually. And it doesn't happen overnight, but it takes time. So you have to keep hammering away at it. All right. Well, with that, I will conclude this episode. So this is Mirabhan Aranchat from Tennis Files. It's a pleasure as always. And I will be getting more sleep these days now, thankfully. And I will see you on the next episode of the Tennis Files podcast. Take care, everyone.
Thanks for listening to the Tennis Files podcast. For more tips to help you improve your tennis game, visit tennisfiles.com.